Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
And Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's impactful to your future and why. On today's program, I'm very, very happy to let everybody know that we have a member of our illustrious crew with us, someone who's joining us for the first time.
A newbie,
CC Concepcion. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We tell everybody about you just a little bit. Like, what are you up to?
Where do I begin? So I am finishing grad school. Thank you, Jesus, for that. Thank you.
Congratulations.
At NYU, and I'm studying design strategy, culture, innovation, and storytelling. Hopefully, I'll be doing something else come day after graduation. Let's see.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up uptown, Washington Heights. Born and raised, New Yorker.
That is We're rare. Manhattan for everybody outside oh, yes, of the yes, Manhattan, uptown, New York uptown. City listening verse.
How could I even presume but
that's
that
all the real New Yorkers
knows.
Will understand yeah. that Washington Heights, uptown, that's what we really represent.
You know, I know.
As a,
I
as
know.
A native day, New Yorker, I don't day. Specify. You got to know. You got to earn the right to know.
We got to get to the brand F-up of the week, and this is when we find something that is so easy for us to find because brands are effing up all the time and in so many different special ways. They're like snowflakes of screw-ups. Phil, what we got this week?
I want to give a shout-out to Rob Fields, you know, one of our illustrious crew, because yes. he actually sent this to us over the weekend. And this F up comes from I almost effed up that F up. This F up comes courtesy of Gap Kids, and the print ad is what we're going to be talking about. The online visual ad is a little better, so we're going to play a little bit of the online ad.
The music, that's the F up.
I'm just so impressed. Y'all are really, really amazing. So you girls are Le Petit Cirque.
We're the only all-humanitarian kid circus.
Fanny, you're the base, so I can see yeah. that you're the one that's lifting everybody. You have to be really strong.
Yeah, mentally and physically. You know, you have your partner, so you both have to trust each other like crazy.
So you get a sense of it.
Yeah, and this is a campaign fronted by famous comedian and talk show host Ellen DeGeneres, and the group Le Petit Cirque is, on the face of it, an awesome group of young girls who are cause-based and clearly amazing at what they do. So we have no issue or exception with them. The issue that comes up is their print ad shows one of the girls, who I believe is one of the oldest of the girls, who is white. And she's standing next to one of the younger girls who's black, and she's kind of leaning her arms on her head. So kind of she's using her like a little shelf. And that's where we feel like there's a disconnect, in the sense that, like I said, the visuals are cool if you're looking at the ad and the explanation for why they chose these young girls to be a part of this ad. But there is something problematic culturally, historically, with the use of this young black girl as a sort of a prop to the older white girl. The imagery is what we're kind of really having an issue here with.
I can see why people are pretty pissed off about this and the critique and the shit Gap is getting because of this. I think that it was an honest mistake. I don't think that it was purposeful. I don't think these things are done on purpose. So that's one thing that we have to consider here. But that doesn't excuse it from happening, because I'm interested in, was there any faces or people in the room that had the insight of that, you know, that history of black people being used as props? And didn't something go off in somebody's head that said, hey, maybe we shouldn't put this one out? I think the biggest critique at Gap is, it's not so much that this came out, but more like, who are the people that you're hiring, and why is there this lack of cultural and political and even social fluency that you would know that that's not good to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think that nails it. That's the deeper point, right? And I think, you know, there's this whole debate about kind of outrage culture and calling people and institutions and companies out online. And I think what's striking about this is it's in, because some people are just going to dismiss it out of hand, right? Some people are going to say this is an exact, this segment itself is an example of like all this PC shit is run amok, yeah. And people can't just even be happy with like, you know, little girls doing a cool project and talking with the nice comedian lady. And the beef isn't with any of that per se. It's exactly what you identified. It's the whole decision structure and chain that sets up a situation where someone, even just over coffee in a brainstorming session, goes, that's not going to be a good look. And then it's pivoted off of in a non, without anything beyond that, mm-hmm. because of who's in the room and the type of empathy and thought that you're bringing to that process. So this is like a little sliver that opens up a whole universe of faulty decision making. And that's why, relatively speaking to other things, it's like a benign F up,
right?
But it's actually goes really deep.
Yeah, it does. And I like to make this distinction with friends sometimes when we're just kind of talking and writing and shooting the shit on Facebook or what have you, that there's a difference between something being racist and something being racial,
mm-hmm.
you know? And to Cece's point, I don't believe there was any malice on behalf of Gap Kids, this group of young girls, Ellen DeGeneres. Like, none of these characters are trying to do anything.
Well, Ellen's a little bit of a white supremacist.
Yeah.
But besides that.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
You went for her neck.
Yeah, but, I saw Ellen's with that Make America Great Again.
Yeah.
I'll just play. Love you, Ellen.
We love you, Ellen.
Are you just mad she has a better haircut than you?
Ooh.
Standing up for the girls.
Me likes you.
I have a very nice haircut. Just because I'm not imitating Justin Bieber does not mean that it is not a well-constructed haircut.
At the bald man in the room,
yeah,
I'm instantly out of all hair conversations.
Keep it simple.
So this is great for me. I could just stand back and watch the fur fly.
I was just about to say we love Ellen, and then you have to go at me like that. So I have to.
I love Ellen too.
Yeah, Ellen's
except
cool.
for her white supremacy.
And she gives great gifts on the holidays. I would love to be in her audience during the holidays.
She
gives away everything.
I have to say, just her brand is nice, but the way it's like, I mean, she's so genuine about it. That I have had no other celebrity encounter, or not personally, but just from watching her show, where I'm like, damn, she really does seem like a very nice person.
Yeah, we so definitely authentic. Sip yeah. the Ellen Kool-Aid.
It's true.
You know,
true.
But nonetheless, I think... Yeah. This is an opportunity for, I think, Gap to just do slightly better. And it's an inclusion issue. You know, if they had that sort of senior person that has authority in the room when they're making these decisions, because many of us who have done, you know, I produced a magazine, Cece, you've done a ton of branding work.
Right.
You know that when you do a photo shoot, there's like 500 to 1,000 pictures that make the final cut.
Right, right.
So they had other options to go with and went with this one. And you know, there was, I don't know, probably 100 other images where we wouldn't even be talking about this right now that would be just as good. And that's the issue right there, that there's no one in that room when they're making that decision to kind of say, hey guys and girls, like let's just pick this other one.
Right.
So a couple of days after this made the rounds, through all the usual digital and internet channels and beyond, the Gap did issue an apology, and we'll read it right here. They go on to say, as a brand with a proud 46-year history of championing diversity and inclusivity, we appreciate the conversation that has taken place and are sorry to anyone we've offended. And this came by the way of Debbie Felix, who is the spokeswoman for Gap, in a statement that was released to Fortune. And, you know, to be honest, on the surface, I'm not sure that even needed to be said, because I don't think, again, like this was that came out of malice. As an apology, it was fine, kind of boilerplate. It's cool that they addressed it to a certain extent to their audience, but I think the bigger issues that we highlighted here are the ones that really need to be addressed. But it was good to see that there was some recognition and it was a decent apology.
Yeah, I mean, it's generic. It's fine. Whatever. And that is the brand F up. Let's get to what's up. All right, so now it's time to get to what's up. And for this week's What's Up, this is a story that came out in Bloomberg last week that chronicled the exploits of a man named Andreas Sepulveda, who is a hacker and a former political operative who's now in jail in Colombia. And he's in jail for some specific crimes he committed in Colombia with regards to intercepting phone calls and hacking. But according to the story that he told Bloomberg, he has worked across Latin America, mainly in the employment of a really prominent Latin American political consultant named J.J. Rendon. And he has helped hack elections, tap phone lines, steal schedules, spread rumors, manipulate voter data, and do all sorts of other sort of technological dark arts for politicians across Latin America, including Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico and President Santos in Colombia, as well as many other countries. And there's a lot of really interesting things about this story that intersect politics, technology, and history. One thing that I didn't like about this, but in some ways it showed that a lot of very traditional elements of manipulating elections, not just in Latin America, but globally, are still happening. They've just been updated for the technology age, right? Like rumors, money distorting elections. He worked, in his case, primarily for right-wing candidates. So there's a history there in Latin America as well. It's just being updated for a new age. It's also important to note that if even, half of what he's saying is true, and it's a very well-reported story with a lot of evidence to back it up, this whole idea that technology is unlocking the capacity for more transparency and a different way of doing elections and a different way of doing politics, we have to remember that the same tools can be used in entirely the opposite direction. And I think that this is like one of those kind of sobering, fascinating stories in that regard. So that's to set it up. Cece, what did you think?
So I thought it was crazy.
It is crazy.
I really was taken with this article. And it read like a script of a movie. Like,
definitely.
I can't wait to see this, who does this, because the turning points in this article was pretty, they went there. And more than anything, what I found interesting was that Sepulveda started with the intention of being kind of like a Robin Hood,
right,
of politics. And that's how he justified what he was doing. You know, he was against the dictatorship and socialist movements in Latin America, definitely was more of a right winger, but he was hoping to, this was for the people.
Yeah. You know, I think it's also, it's technology and it's media. I mean, just last week we had a high ranking person from the Nixon administration come out and said that the way in which they knew in Nixon's time that they would be able to disrupt black power movements and more socially active movements was to link those movements to drug use and then target leaders of those movements and align them very closely to narcotics and basically begin the very early nation stages of the what we've come to think of popularly as the war on drugs. And Nixon obviously went on to break into the Watergate building, where we've popularly gotten the gate attached to every scandal. So In a way,
Philgate,
you know, which is raging here in the
studio.
Dope
Boys universe, you know. That's a problem.
So, you know, we're seeing this sort of replayed over and over. But to your point, Michael, it's updated to a new, using the tools that we have available in our times, which is obviously the high level of technology, which is being used to manipulate media and people's perception of candidates. And in this guy's case, it was used to manipulate on the benefit to the right wing movements prevalent in these countries.
Yeah, and a couple more things to add to that. So, like, examples of this include, you know, on a more, I guess, a more expected level, like creating fake Twitter armies to spread a rumor. On the flip side, setting up a call, like one of those sort of like, I'm actually forgetting the term, but basically like an automated call to get like out
the
vote.
A
robocall, exactly. Yeah. A robocall for a candidate, an opposing candidate that went out in the middle of the night. So that when people got the call, they were angry at the candidate because they perceived that they were sending out something in the middle of the night. Another kind of interesting lens on this story for me is J.J. Rendon, who, as I mentioned before, is the dude who subcontracted Sepulveda. And Sepulveda is a tech dude. You know, he's a hacker. He does these types of operations. J.J. Rendon is a strategist responsible for every aspect, more of like a James Carville, David Axelrod kind of figure. His image in the United States, to the extent that he has one in the Latin American communities, frequently on Fusion and Spanish language media. But he's also known as like an activist for democracy against the Venezuelan government and against Hugo Chavez and now Maduro. And I don't have any like brief for the Venezuelan government. I'm sure that they have fouled up in many, many ways. I'm also sure that in some ways they've delivered and that the picture is a little bit more complicated than we would think either way. But what I do find fascinating is that he's been able to carve an image and speak at like TEDx and sort of talk about restoring democracy in Venezuela and sell a certain image as an activist while he's involved in, you know, like to say the least, incredibly questionable campaign disputes. Absolutely. In Latin America. And it's just like another one of these gaps where that same sensitivity actually in the gap conversation that like what pushes people to actually say, well, wait, what does this work does this person do in a part of the world that I'm unfamiliar with, even though it's like our neighborhood?
One of the quotes that really jumped out to me that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read this directly from the article because it made me think about something that's going on right now. He says, "When I realized that people believe what the internet says more than reality, I discovered that I had the power to make people believe almost anything."
Right.
As we're recording, there's the back and forth between someone like Sarah Palin, Azalea Banks, who reacted to a satirical / fake news story.
Right.
Where Sarah Palin, I believe she said that black people liked slavery and were into slavery. Then Azalea Banks went in on her and kind of.
And what's so funny is when I heard later it was satirical, but it didn't even register. When I saw that headline, I didn't even doubt that she said that for a second.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, sure.
Yeah. It wouldn't have made any, like, she's so abhorrent that, of course, to her credit, Azalea Banks' credit, like, you could believe it because the person is so terrible.
Definitely.
But if you knew anything about the website, you would know that this was not a real story.
Right.
And we've become accustomed to just, if it's on the internet, whether it's in a meme or it's on a website or it's on Twitter, unless you do some due diligence, a lot of people just run with these things.
Right.
And to a certain extent, these actors took that sort of very human thing that has become now become a thing and run with it to the benefit of their candidates. That, you know what? It doesn't matter if it's true. It doesn't matter if the Twitter accounts are fake or the robocalls are false or what have you. If you put it out there enough, people will believe it.
Right.
And it allows them to manipulate. You know, that media manipulation is such a powerful force.
Right. And I think some people are going to look at him as a hero, and while others are going to look at him as a criminal. I mean, I can't get over the fact that he sleeps with a bulletproof vest. He sleeps with a bulletproof vest and a blanket, and he's checked on the hour. And just to give you some context, there is people want him dead, and a lot of it comes from these political parties in Latin America and who they're associated with, and you can imagine what that could be.
Part of how he fell out actually was that, you know, Rendon, again, the guy who hired him, who I should say denies sort of hiring him and working with him, but it seems, you know, there's some evidence to point that they definitely did work together, brought him on to work for the president of Colombia, Manuel Santos. And Santos, who's a right-wing dude, actually shifted and started negotiating with the FARC. And this guy, Sepulveda, opposed that, negotiating with the rebels. And went to work for a right-wing challenger to the president of Colombia. And he's a citizen of Colombia and employing those same tactics in a state that you actually live in is obviously why he got, that's a dangerous proposition. You know what I mean? Like to go after the people who run the place that you actually are. Going back to the invasion of Iraq, someone in the Bush administration said like you're part of the reality-based community in like an insulting way. In the sense that, like, we create our own reality. Mm-hmm. And the distinction is that's so amazing about this is that it's a whole other level than just spinning and getting out the right message and massaging it. It's literally that there is an entirely different infrastructure that you can create a totally new and warped reality from. And, you know, he said in the piece, he has no doubt that these are employed, you know, in the United States, in Europe, wherever. And this is going to be like not just the big like, oh, now people can tweet at their congressman. This is going to be the big story of campaigning in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
And how you rein that in. And that's why it's What's Up.
So now we're going to jump into what's good, and we're going to be talking about the gig economy. And there was a recent article in the New York Times by the writer Neil Irwin, who states in the title of the article is, "With gigs instead of jobs, workers bear new burdens." And basically the article highlights what's popularly known as the gig economy, where instead of people working in traditional environments where they have the trappings of retirement plans and healthcare and benefits and all the rest, they're walking to offices, they work more as freelancers in various ways. Most popularly, people can think of something like an Uber driver. That would be sort of the perfect one-off manifestation of someone working within the gig economy in that they make their own hours, they sort of set their own schedule, but they're largely responsible for many of the trappings that used to come with traditional employment. And this article summarizes a much longer research paper by two Princeton economists by the name of Lawrence F. Katz and Alan B. Kruger. And the name of their research paper is The Rise and Nature of Alternative Work Arrangements in the United States. And what they've done is basically highlight that most of the jobs that we've seen created in the last 5 to 7 years since the Great Recession, as is most widely known, have come through this gig economy where people are working largely as freelancers and what have you. And why this is important is that if you look out sort of a longer time frame, as the nature of work changes, the nature of capitalism, something that we've talked about a lot on this show, as sort of traditional and industrial age capitalism changes to embrace more of a technology and digital field, what does that mean for those who are coming out that are highly skilled and highly educated, but not yet finding the ability to work within traditional corporate environments? And you see this sort of downward work pressure, the inability to find work in your chosen vocation. So there's a lot of implications to this report, largely beyond the things that people might glom onto, which is Uber is bad and things like that, that I think are worth discussing, particularly for those of us who are creatives.
What always occurs to me when I look at information like this and talk to people about this stuff is that the problem we have today is that two things that could be very different tracks get mushed and blurred together, right? So there is this freedom and possibility that's opened up by something like the Uber app, right? So you have the app on your phone, you can call it, you get a car whenever you want, and it allows drivers on the positive end to have discretion over their schedule and more freedom and more flexibility. In Europe, there's some taxi cab unions that are developing an apps with like the same functionality. Okay, so the way, though, on the other hand, so same flexibility, same delivery for people looking for convenience and looking for that fast access. But on the other hand, not with that like attack on union labor, not with that attack on, you know, sort of some stability and sense of investment in people's futures. So I think the big sort of defining question about all of this stuff is how do you decouple the innovations in technology that make people more free and more capable to move and innovate from just bad economic ideas that fuck people over? And it's sold as they're the same thing. You can't have one without the other, but that's not true. So that to me is like always the question that emerges out of these conversations.
I take a different approach to this article, and more so because I think the gig economy is a new normal. You know, this is what's the work field or the work industry is becoming. And I think there's a certain level of freedom in that. And you see a lot more creativity coming out of these gig economies because people are choosing this. They're choosing to say, I'd rather be a freelancer than go work for a company and have to give them my 9 to 5 or 9 to 7 for a little bit amount of money. And I'm still not doing what I love. So I think a lot, especially the new, you know, the generation coming out of school right now, they're choosing, and especially with technology and then being able to put up a website, put up a product and sell right away, like you're straight to consumer, they can make money a lot faster and they have autonomy in expressing themselves how they want to. That's it.
I mean, my beef with what you said, I mean, I agree with you in the sense that obviously it does create more flexibility. And that's a good thing. And I think anybody who's even in this room right now is part of that. You're making decisions based off of your instincts. Mm-hmm. You want to create something that's more durable, that's more resilient, meaningful, fun, all of that. But like, even when you talk about millennials, and I mean, speaking anecdotally and statistically, like, yes, there's less of a mindset of like, I want to go and find a 9 to 5 job, no doubt. But there's also a lot of people that are like, oh, fuck, I need to figure out some type of little internet business because that 9 to 5 job is not there.
Right.
And there's a lot of the way these kind of even like PSFK, like positioning that report. Some people are choosing because they want to. Some people are forced to make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is somewhere in between. So what I'm trying to say is not that this isn't potentially incredibly positive, but the infrastructure in place around it doesn't match it. So like, in other words, if you want to just take it on the flip side of like social insurance, which this article mentions, you can't build a system that is saying like, all right, you're not going to get benefits from your company. You're not going to have any of this type of setup. And we're still going to pretty much have like a system that is built on pretty much your retirement, your healthcare, and everything else is taken care of by an employment relationship that doesn't exist anymore. And I think when you look at it from like this economic perspective, like this piece does, it gets to all of that. But in the popular conversation, we're still more like in this, you know, we're just making different choices and that's cool, but that's not the context. And that's how people get fucked over.
Right. Yeah. And some of those choices, like what are the alternatives? And I think when everyone is forced to be in these spaces, you have this sort of inevitable downward pressure on wages. You know, so if all of us are freelancers to a certain extent, and the technology has made it so that when I think about when I used to publish Free Magazine, this sort of culture lifestyle magazine a few years ago, in one way I look at it and I say like, wow, if we had like smartphones with the technology that they have and the video that they have, the capabilities to sort of produce and create and print, we could have done so much more. But then when I also think about the photographers we hired, the writers we paid, like in a way we wouldn't have had to do any of that and our cost of production would have been really low. But then sort of the rising tide that lifts all boats would not have been there at all, even for our little publication. Like, we wouldn't have been able to pay, you know, we wouldn't have needed to pay certain photographers. Like, we could have done everything with our iPhones. We could have done everything with just the very basic tools, set up our own sites with WordPress and 3D printed the magazine and done, and everything would have been great because we would have been able to produce. But then at the cost basis of sort of employing particularly other creatives and bring them along would have been unnecessary. And that's what really worries me about this, is that as all of us or many of us are sort of, whether we choose it or we're pushed into it, we're competing with someone who's always willing to do it for less.
Right.
So if we have that, you know, Fortune 500 company who wants to hire someone to do video work, like, sure, they can hire like a fully formed staff, but could they also go and get a bunch of students from SVA or NYU or any notable school and say like, hey guys, meet us here with your iPhones and film this DIY and we'll give you like some food and course credits and then you kind of move on.
And the expectation gets reset. Like, yeah. I've had many conversations in this like particular kind of like gray area where you're at, like, you know, you have some profile, you're actually established in what you do. There is like professional recognition, but you're not like, you know, a household name, but like you're in the game, right? Like, and the expectation set of a lot of companies is like, you know, again, like the classic, like, we'll offer you this blah, blah, blah platform, versus like, in the past, it's like, obviously the preset is you're going to get paid something because you're doing something mm-hmm. for us, right? And I guess the point is that even in the arrangement that Phil outlined, like, money is still being generated. It's just getting generated. It's going to Apple. It's going to Google. It's going, like, so unless we flip it where somehow at some end on this chain, there's actual value that's being created for people and different ways of ownership or whatever, it's gonna be a blessing and a curse, you know. It's not a surprise to me that at the same time that like the PSFK report and everything is documenting that more and more millennials want to like have a meaningful, interesting work life, like you were mm-hmm. saying, they love Bernie Sanders. And I'll be trans, you know, I like the dude too.
Right.
So simultaneously it's like more freedom, more expression, more independence, and like build us an actual country
right.
that we can operate in.
Yeah. And do those expectations for all of us, do they match the reality of how we're designing the current workforce?
Right.
And
right.
it's something that I always think about because I, you know, with creating Influencer Conference, you know, it's this incredible platform where we know all these amazing people globally. And in many ways, I've always felt that you're limited to a certain extent by the structure, the existing structure of corporate work, because if you have your own shop, your 3-4 person shop, even in a way you're compensated. If I think about agency payments, you know, they come to, for those who are not familiar, you know, if you're working for a corporation or agency or what have you, any large organization, they'll largely pay you with a 90 to 120 day pay schedule.
Right.
So you do work in June, you're probably not going to see that check or payment till September, October.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, you might need to. I have a freelance yeah. photographer friend who, like, he had to take an agency to court.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a cash management tool.
Yeah. And not take it to court, but you definitely are chasing checks.
Yeah. And that's a cash management tool. That's, as a former Wall Streeter, that's just a tool for corporations to hold on to their cash, to make interest on that, and yep. handle their kind of short term payments while extending when they have to pay any person, whether that's another large organization or even a small organization. So it doesn't really, it's not a size thing, but it adversely affects independent contractors, freelancers, and small organizations because they right. need that money more so. Like if I'm at Goldman and we owe money to Morgan Stanley, just an example, another large firm, for whatever reason, Morgan Stanley's gonna be okay. But if Goldman owes that money to a 3-person shop for design work or whatever it is that they needed, then that person might not be okay. Those persons need that to pay their workers, to make other payments on time, to pay their rent. And so in a way, that system creates a unofficial serfdom where small organizations and independent operators are beholden to these larger organizations for payments on a fairly arbitrary basis of a 90 to 120 days. And if you're an entrepreneur, 120 days can put you out of business.
Right, I agree.
You know, and that's a serious thing.
And it's kind of like, yeah, it's like basically you're being, in this economy, you're being asked to like run a triathlon when you're still pretty out of shape. Like the foundations are not there for what could be really cool.
Right, right.
It's good. So now it's time for digging in the crates. This is where we give you a pick from anything that's good in culture from anywhere, anytime, any place. Cece, what you got for us?
Okay, so I'm super excited about Terrace Martin, who is like a triple threat. He plays music, he sings, he raps. He did a lot of the instrumentation on Kendrick's album. And he just dropped his new album called Velvet Portraits, and it is on repeat. I am excited about this guy, and I can't wait to see him live. I want to get all dressed up and put some lipstick on and go vibe out with Terrace Martin.
Nice. So follow that.
I'm not going to have lipstick on.
I hope not.
But I got two music picks as well. A band by the name of Lucius. They're out of Brooklyn. And I got a chance to check them out at Music Hall of Williamsburg last week, and they put on an amazing show. They're great. And a woman by the name of Anna Wise, who also coincidentally works a lot with Kendrick Lamar. So it's crazy that we both have two sort of Kendrick satellites in there. But Anna Wise, she's a singer. Hard to describe her music. I hate music labels in any case, but just listen to her music. So Anna Wise and the band Lucius.
I want to recommend a documentary that came out, I think, actually in 2010 for the World Cup at the time. It's called The Two Escobars, and it was an ESPN documentary on soccer and Colombian drug cartels and how they kind of helped fund and create Colombian soccer. And then the death of Andres Escobar, who was a soccer player who scored an own goal for the Colombian team. We're not really for the Colombian team, obviously, at the World Cup in 1992. And then he was assassinated when he got back to Colombia several months later for that. And there's a really interesting story there about drugs and sports and violence and Colombia. And it's really, really well made. So that's my pick for this week. Cece, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It's a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, man.
Matt Leck, our super producer, never would be possible without you. Thank you so much. Phil, another expedition, brother.
Yep, veteran.
See you Thursday. Thanks, everybody. Brother.